As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Before we start the show, we just want to let you know about The Athletic's Black Friday deal. Starting Monday night at 5 p.m. Eastern, The Athletic's great writing is just $1 a month for 12 months. Go to theathletic.com/spinrate to lock in our very best price of the year. Just $1 a month for new subscribers to The Athletic. Go there now. But as I said, this is Spin Rate, The Athletic's Toronto Blue Jays podcast. My name is Drew Fairservice, and we're so excited to be back at you again, for the second time in like a week. It's November. What kind of baseball stuff could you talk about in November? Let me tell you, we're here to talk awards. Blue Jays figured prominently throughout the award season. And we got lots to talk about. And when I say we, I mean, of course, me, Drew, co-host of Spin Rate, being joined by a person who voted for one of these awards. She covers the Toronto Blue Jays for The Athletic. Her name is Caitlin McGrath. She's the co-host of Spin Rate. Caitlin, welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome back to you as well.
Welcome back to us all. Welcome back to everyone for listening. Thank you so much for sticking with us, for dialing us up here in November. The weather is weird and wet, but that doesn't mean there's not baseball stuff to talk about, transactions to look forward to, 40-man roster machinations to chew on. But I think the most important thing, before I get away from myself, thank you so much for listening. If this is your first time, I can't encourage you enough to subscribe to the show. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If it's Spotify or Apple Podcasts, dial it up, hit the like, whatever. Make sure you get them beamed right into your phone as soon as they're live. Hit us with a review, with a like, thumbs up, whatever it is. We appreciate it. Helps the show, feeds the algorithm, makes me feel real good. I mentioned off the top the hot deal. Make sure you go to theathletic.com/spinrate and sign up. Get that sweet, sweet dollar a month and let them know that you're listening to us so we can continue living in the style to which we have grown accustomed, which is to just saunter in here in the winter and talk about awards. We talked, if you missed it earlier this week, we talked about Jose Berríos, who has picked up an award on his own. Not only did he pick up some Cy Young votes, he also picked up a big-ass contract extension, 7 years, $131 million for the Blue Jays, free agent to be at the end of 2022. Before any work stoppage ugliness, Jose Berríos committed himself to the Toronto Blue Jays. So if you haven't heard that one, which we recorded before the press conference, Caitlin, you were there, I assume.
Yes.
What was your big takeaway, other than Jose Berríos has cute kids?
Yes, his three children were there. His family was there, and they were very cute. And I guess this had been the first time the whole family had been in Toronto, and they were enjoying it. And that was, I think, the big takeaway from it, was that how charmed he and his family was with Toronto so quickly. And, you know, Berríos, like you said all the right things, and things that stuck out was that, you know, within 2 months of playing with the Blue Jays and spending 2 months in Toronto, he was sort of seen enough that he knew he wanted to live in this city for 7 more years at least. And he also wanted to be part of the Blue Jays organization, the way that they treated him. They made him feel comfortable. Obviously, it helps that they're a pretty young, talented team that was oh so close to getting to the postseason. So I'm sure there, not that he was going to go anywhere next year, but I'm sure there's sort of an understanding that the team sort of knows what they're doing in terms of building a winning product, or at least he believes they do. So he wants to stick around, and obviously they gave him the money, which I think was a pretty fair contract for both sides. And yeah, it was actually also just kind of neat to have an in-person press conference. We haven't had one in so long that I was actually like surprised, like when I got the email of like, oh yeah, those things, we used to do those all the time. These are things that happened. It would just been had sent like George Springer's press conference, whatever, was on Zoom last winter whenever we had it. And so to have an in-person press conference and yeah, like have his whole family there, have him there, have Ross there, and you know, all the media were there, and some of his team were there, like a close friend and his agent was there. So it's been a long time since we've had that. Obviously the Ryu one sticks out for kind of how big a deal it was with Scott Boras there. But yeah, like, so yeah, it was good to get back to the Rogers Center and see all that. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if you had any takeaways from it or if you're kind of in agreement that it was just kind of more of the right things were being said, and you can kind of, there's a lot of truth to what Mark and Ross have been saying all along, is like, we're building this team to want to be a place where players want to play.
I don't want to be overly cynical and say that, yeah, everyone was just saying the right thing on the day that this big contract got signed, but it does get back to something that we talked about on the show that we recorded ahead of that press conference, which was Mark Shapiro is doing what he said he was going to do, and it's working. But Berríos was impressed by and attracted to the things that Shapiro has been saying all along. And the line I used on the last show that ended up in the social clip, which is about like wanting to make the Blue Jays a modern professional sports business that is attractive and appealing and helps players think that they can achieve, you know, their best version of themselves. And Jose Berríos did nothing to dispel that belief that the Blue Jays are doing the things that they said they're going to do. Easy to get on board when you're throwing a 7-year contract underneath the nose of a pitcher, but also at the same time, he could have waited and signed a 6-year contract next year. Like, there's almost no doubt that he would have got a 6-year, $120 million deal mm-hmm. come next winter. And the other thing was that I love Jose Berríos for saying how much he enjoyed Toronto, having spent September, the objectively best month of the year on the calendar in any city, but more specifically Toronto. Toronto in September is about as good as it gets. The weather is phenomenal. The city is full and brimming with good times. You know, when the universities fill back up and it's just like there's so much energy and stuff going on and people are out and the nights are cool but wonderful. It's an easy sell. The Blue Jays should think about doing this from now on. Hang out somewhere else, come back, be like, hey, look at this, beautiful end of summer. You know, those special summer nights, the next thing you know, you're at Bitwando's getting a big-ass piece of pizza in the middle of the 2:00 in the morning. You've never lived until you've done such a thing. Jose Berríos told me personally he loves Bitwando's, so there you go. He didn't tell me that. But let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Does Jose Berríos, who now is, you know, long time commitment, great player coming off a great year. I believe he finished 7th in the Cy Young voting in the American League. Does Jose Berríos get the ball on opening day in Toronto in 2022?
I guess it depends who else they sign. I think the rotation is hardly set at this point. And so do they open? They don't. I believe they open on the road. I believe they open in Baltimore, actually.
I can't believe you just in my opening day. Home opener, opening day. You're killing me. You're splitting hairs when I misspoke.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I deserve even worse. You have said the thing that needs to be said, which is, of course, that Jose Berríos finished 7th. But if the Blue Jays are able to sign the American League Cy Young Award winner himself, Robbie Ray, which is to say they would re-sign him, Robbie Ray would then start
probably
on opening day. I don't think if there's nobody else that the Blue Jays are going to sign, that they're going to start ahead of Berríos, straight up. That's me telling you that if, even if they sign Max Scherzer, he's not starting on opening day over Jose Berríos. mostly because they're not going to sign Max Scherzer. But nonetheless, Robbie Ray won the Cy Young. Let's talk about that. It was, in the end, a little bit less dramatic than I think a lot of people expected. 29 first-place votes. One single first-place vote extended to Gerrit Cole. 29 votes, first place, Robbie Ray. Pretty much slam dunk. Is that what you expected? Did you think he was going to get so much support to take the award home?
I thought he was going to win. I didn't think it would be that much of a landslide. I thought that Gerrit Cole would get like a handful at least of votes. I don't know, like first place votes, like 5, 6, 7, whatever it is. Just because like some of the rate stats liked Gerrit Cole better, you know, like strikeouts per nine, walks per nine, home runs per nine, probably like those types of stats tended to skew more towards Gerrit Cole. Whereas like some of the just sort of number stats, like innings pitched, strikeouts, that stuff was Robbie Ray. And so, not really knowing how exactly people were going to vote. I just kind of assumed there would be some people that would throw Gerrit Cole some first place votes just based on, you know, those statistics. And the fact that he was, you know, he is a very good pitcher. I think a couple things helped Robbie Ray. I think that, well, one is that he did pitch the most. I think it does help that he had the innings pitched and also the ERA title, like those things, and the strikeouts. Those things have a lot of weight to them. I think it helped also that Robbie Ray, if anything, finished strong in the second half. Like we have to remember, like Robbie Ray was not even an all-star. Like he was not, he wasn't even an all-star. And his first half was fine. Like he was doing a lot of things in the first half that he was doing in the second half. You know, he wasn't like a lot of things that were like the sort of bedrock of his success this season. He was doing in the first half. He wasn't walking as many guys. And yes, he was allowing the occasional home runs, but he was striking out a lot of guys. He was pitching pretty deep in games, but it was still like somewhat under the radar, and he had more of his sort of like really standout performances happened in the second half. So I think that maybe you talked about that. Maybe we've talked about that before, but this sort of like the recency bias of like the fact that he had a really good second half and Gerrit Cole kind of faded down the stretch. Obviously like Ray had that, you know, unfortunate bad start against the Yankees. It wasn't even that bad of a start. He was like 4 hits, 4 home runs, which is kind of just unfortunate. But, but generally speaking, Robbie Ray had a really good, like a really good July, really good August. Like those months were like really good for him. I also think that Robbie Ray never got caught up whatsoever in the, like spider tack, like foreign substance controversy. And I think that goes back to the original point, whereas like he was pretty consistent throughout the season. Like there really wasn't anything about his spin rate or like any sort of suspect type of performance where it was like going up and down, you know, around the time where they were cracking down on that kind of stuff. So I think that helped. I also think like, even though I kind of wrote about the fact that nobody votes based on a pitcher's story, and I don't think it is a primary reason why voters vote for guys, but I think that the fact that Robbie Ray led a Blue Jays team, a young Blue Jays team, really on the cusp of playoffs, and he was coming back from such a, you know, tough year, and I, you know, it was like kind of an unlikely story of this guy really rebounding and remaking himself, or not even remaking himself, but just like fulfilling the potential, I guess, that was always there. You know, maybe that does sway some voters a little bit. And I don't know. It just is, it's interesting because I think a lot of people would say that because Robbie Ray pitched in Toronto, like sometimes those pitchers don't get noticed as much because obviously the Blue Jays games aren't on in the U.S. as much. And a guy like Gerrit Cole pitching, and also Lance Lynn, honestly, like pitching for the White Sox and pitching for the Yankees, those are two teams that get a lot of attention all the time, but especially like recently. Well, the Yankees always, but recently for the White Sox, you know, they're on national games. They play a lot. A lot of voters would see them more often than they would see Robbie Ray. And so that's kind of also why I thought it would be closer, just because I didn't think that Robbie Ray would have as many eyes on him. But it is what it is. And, you know, it's funny when it ends up being 29 and then there's just one guy. Because I guarantee that one guy that voted for Cole probably thought there was going to be more votes for Cole. Obviously, he thought Cole was worthy. But I would be surprised if he thought, oh, I'm going to be the one guy that stands out. I would assume that obviously if he thought Cole was the winner, then he thought that Cole would get more than his one single first place vote.
Mm-hmm. Jason Beck, of course, who covers the Tigers and has for a very long time. Someone who is known to be good at their job. So, look, I have a few things, and this will come back a few times as we're talking here, which is, especially when it comes to down ballot stuff, as I tweeted about this a little bit during the awards week, was like, I'm a messy bitch that loves drama. The more, like, random, give me all, as long as it doesn't, like, hurt, actively affect the process, I am so down for, like, some down ballot nonsense. Just bring me all the Homer votes. Bring me all the foolishness. You know, I want someone to twist themselves into a pretzel, justifying it in their column that they get, like, that they, the reason they made this crazy vote in the first place was so they could get a column out of it down the road. Love it. Love every single second of it. But I think that, you know, and we talked a little bit about this off the air, and I think that, it's worth mentioning on as we were recording here also, like, Alex Speer of the Boston Globe wrote a really interesting column about what his thought process was and how he's going to vote and how he's maybe not going to use numbers like wins above replacement as a kind of go-to or default for when, especially when it comes to voting for the Cy Young, that it's sometimes you know, we've kind of got maybe a little bit lost when it comes to how do we parse the value? How do you make the decision? Who is the best pitcher? And what's the way that we're evaluating that? And, you know, Alex Speer's vote is pretty much, you know, I don't know, maybe chalk isn't the right way to say it, a little bit on non-standard in that he went Ray Cole, Nate Eovaldi, Lance Lynn, and then, Frankie Montes of the A's. So, you know, I think that you can make a pretty strong case for Eovaldi, although it's just not as strong as Ray. I think in terms of runs allowed, in terms of innings pitched, like so many of those things, you know, I don't think it needs to get too much more complicated than that. And you can start to, like, figure out, like, where did some of these things come? Where did some of these things stand out? Is there any sort of, like, thing that maybe you don't want to give somebody credit for? And, you know, as you said off air, like, it's important that if we're voting for an award, not to use, like, forward projecting numbers as opposed to, like, what is it that happened? We need, mm-hmm. you need some storytelling stats. If we're going to do an award, because that's what you're awarding, right? Is who had the best season. And we can go crazy with component numbers, and maybe FIP and things like that aren't exactly ideal for award season. But there, you know, at the end of the day, Ray led the American League in starters in wins above replacement, the baseball reference version, which is based off of runs allowed, which to me sounds a lot like, you know, things that happened as opposed to things that should have happened or could have happened or a different model of successful starting pitching. So Robbie Ray led the league in win probability added, which is, again, pitching big innings and and being effective when they matter most for a starting pitcher. To me, that's huge. You know, he, again, being right up there. Also, shout out Shohei Ohtani, sixth among starting pitchers for win probability added, even though he only threw 130 innings. But we'll get to that too. So a great season for Robbie Ray, 29 first place votes. There's not much else that can be said. Jose Barrios picked up a handful of votes, actually, as I mentioned before, when he finished seventh. He picked up a third place vote, a fourth place vote, and three fifth place votes. The dude, Arden Zwelling, had Barrios fourth on his ballot. But he wasn't, you know, wasn't a Toronto writer. It was Allison Footer, who covers the Astros for MLB.com, who voted for Jose Barrios third. Jose Barrios, it doesn't maybe have the same sparkling numbers as Gerrit Cole in terms of ERA or strikeouts or you know, some of the other kind of front runners. But Jose Barrios did this year what the Blue Jays hope and effectively paid for, which is that he was a very good above average pitcher who took the ball 30, 31, 32 times and went out and did his job and pitched, mm-hmm. you know, five, six innings. And that's what you're going to get. And that might not win you a Cy Young, but that's the basis for a good team, frankly. So shout out to Jose Barrios for a great season and picking up those big votes.
Yeah.
Yeah, she says. Not much else to say about that.
No, and I thought, I don't know if you watched it, I thought Robbie Ray's reaction was really great. He had his whole family there, his oldest son kind of stole the show a little bit, which kind of happens when you have kids on live TV. And afterwards he had a conference call with us and he was really happy and really appreciative. And I kind of said to him, like in one of my questions, like we would kind of carefully broach the topic of Cy Young especially throughout August and September when he was really heading towards looking like a favorite for it. And he really didn't want to like touch it too much other than just to sort of say like, it's great. But I'm just focusing on the team and all that kind of stuff, which is what you expect him to say. But he said when we brought it up, like, Well, now I love talking about it. Like now that I have the award, I don't mind talking about it, which
good for him.
Yeah, touche.
We'll be right back with more Spin Rate, but first, check this out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I mentioned him already. And Robbie Ray was not unanimous. 29 out of 30 first place votes. The MVP vote that we kind of knew was going to go this way was in fact unanimous. A great performance by starting pitcher Shohei Ohtani. He was, even though he only threw 130 innings, he again was one of the best pitchers in high leverage situations among starters. It's interesting to see he was a 3 wins above replacement as a pitcher, but is it somewhat surprising that as a pitcher with that kind of record would win the most valuable player running away unanimous?
Did he do something else on the field?
He did do something else. He was also a 5 win DH, hitting 46 home runs and leading second in the league in OPS, and led the league, all of baseball, in win probability added for hitters. So when you combine those two things, which you're allowed to do because the same fucking guy did them, you have not only the American League MVP unanimous, 30 first place votes. You also have, and I've said this a hundred times, and I'll keep saying it until it's something changes, the single greatest season I've ever seen in my entire life in any sport. Truly unbelievable. Shocking, like the fact that he did it is shocking. And I spent a full day arguing with people. I spent more than a full day arguing it with people about it and whether he deserves it. It's crazy to me. I tried to be good. I wasn't belittling anyone. I got blocked by some guy who I thought I was just like, anyway. But like, I can't believe that there would be people, even the both dyed in Blue Jays fans, who think that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. deserved the MVP over Shohei Ohtani. It's crazy to me. But that doesn't take anything away from the fact that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at 22 years old had an unbelievable season. An unbelievable season with unbelievable and unprecedented barriers in his way, as he and his team were forced to play in 3 different home ballparks. Mm-hmm. And Vlad had an unreal season. He did. It was insane. What did he end up with? 48 home runs. Yep. By some measures, led the American League in, he didn't lead the American League in any wins above replacement, led the American League in almost all offensive categories in terms of weighted runs created plus, deserved runs created, weighted on base, again, home runs, was in the top, 2-3 for batting average. A truly amazing season, a glimpse of what's to come, and a well-deserved second place finish that most years is going to get it done. But the year that the same guy throws 130, like, extremely good innings and hits 46 home runs, that's the MVP. There's no way of getting around it.
Yeah, exactly. And Vladdy was almost unanimous second place winner. There was one Salvador Perez.
There was. Bring it on. So, bring me that that down ballot nonsense.
But obviously I agree with everything. I, you know, didn't really wade too much into the discourse of the MVP because I didn't vote. I didn't have an MVP vote, and I wasn't writing on it. So I didn't really wade into it. I saw enough sort of Blue Jays fans also kind of understanding and completely realizing why Vladdy mm-hmm. came in second. So there were people out there that saw what Shohei did and was like, yes, obviously that is the MVP. But you're right. And let's not forget Marcus Semien coming in third. So the fact that the Blue Jays had two MVP finalists, obviously there was some down ballot guys that got some votes. Your boy T. Oscar got a handful of low votes.
He didn't get a handful. He got one.
Oh, he got one
eighth place vote, ninth place vote. But that's still so awesome. Bring it on. Bring me all the down ballot homer vote bullshit. Love it.
Yeah. So Bo Bichette got a handful
he did.
Of votes.
That's crazy. He got four votes. Good for him.
And Robbie Ray got a vote as well. So
he did.
Yeah. So
five Blue Jays received votes.
Yeah.
Wait, one, two. Yep. Three, four, five. Five yep. Blue Jays got MVP votes. Two Blue Jays got a shitload of MVP mm-hmm. votes. Man, this team, Cy Young Award winner, five guys in the MVP ballot. We haven't even got to the other awards. They must have won the World Series in a walk.
What? You would have thought.
Okay, well, let me ask you then.
Well, wait, but there was another. I feel like there was. Was there not something? I mean, also, I guess the Angels having the MVP and not making the playoffs. But I feel like there was another team that was similarly had a lot of standout performances and didn't make the playoffs. Maybe I'm just imagining it.
Well, there's one Astro, not two Astros. Jose Altuve got a couple votes. Kyle mm-hmm. Tucker got a couple votes. You know, hardly any Rays. And that's sort of the magic, I think, of yeah. the Rays. And what makes them so sexy is that Brandon Lau got the most MVP votes of anybody on the Rays. He was down there below Cedric Mullins, who got a ton of MVP votes, including a fourth place vote on a team that lost 100 games, which is where mm-hmm. I was going to go with this. And what do you okay. think about that? Do you think about that most valuable player, as it's written, or as you understand it, or as you prefer to interpret it, is it rewarding the most outstanding season and irrespective of team record? Or do you think that there needs to be some kind of consideration for the quality of the team the player is on?
Okay, a few things. One, I think that I don't think there's any criteria that is sort of listed. I know for Hall of Fame voting, there is sort of criteria that they kind of spell out. Obviously, mm-hmm. there's that kind of infamous character clause. Whereas for the year-end awards, I don't think there's really any specific criteria as that would sort of parse that out. So I guess it is really up to what people think. I mean, I think if it is a difference between let's just pick, if it's a difference, if Vlad and Aaron Judge, for example, and let's just take Shohei out of it, right? He doesn't exist in this. Mm-hmm. And so if it's Aaron Judge and Vlad, and they've had very similar seasons, and you're trying to say, okay, who gets it, and the Blue Jays miss the playoffs, and the Yankees get in, maybe beating the Blue Jays to get in that specific scenario, I would say maybe you have to weigh team performance a little bit, just because you're kind of trying to split hairs a little bit and say who is the MVP. But I think when there's such a standout, spectacular individual performance, it kind of transcends team. And that's exactly what Shohei Ohtani was. Mm-hmm. And so had Vlad led the Blue Jays to the playoffs, I still don't think he would have won. No. Maybe if the Blue Jays had won the AL East or something, dominated, even then, I don't know that he would have won. I think maybe he would have got some first place votes potentially. And I was kind of I kind of waffled throughout the year in the sense of I don't know, maybe Vlad will get a couple first place votes from people that do kind of weigh. And that was also thinking maybe the Blue Jays will get in the playoffs and all this kind of stuff. But also you can then make the argument that maybe Marcus Semien was the MVP of the Blue Jays because he was not as much of a well-rounded hitter as Vlad was. Certainly basically was like very close to power. Obviously he had 45 home runs and Vlad had 48, but he also delivered a lot more defensively, played 162 games, and Vlad only missed like one or two games.
So he only missed one. He played 161.
161? Okay. Yeah. I couldn't remember if he missed one more at the end of the season.
Remember that was the game they taped him to the bench.
Yes, I remember that. I knew he didn't play 162. I just didn't know if it was 161 or 160. But also just playing second base. Obviously, Semien was one of the best second base. Well, like Gold Glove second baseman, one of the best.
Exactly.
Based on other defensive metrics. And so you could make the argument that Semien was actually the MVP of the Blue Jays, and maybe Robbie Ray was second, and then there's Vlad. Like, there's actually a lot of individual performance on the Blue Jays that really stood out. So I think that I would just go back to my original point of that, like, it's for me, if I was to vote for MVP, it would, I don't know that I would go into any year saying these are my standards and this is how I vote. Like, it would probably be a case by case thing and just see like how the season goes, who the performers are, and what have they done to stand out. And then, as I say, if it's splitting ties, then you might look at team or position or, you know, all these different things to sort of parse that out.
And some of that stuff is built into like the component stats, like a wins above replacement, right? Mm-hmm. So by Baseball Reference, Marcus Semien was better than Vlad.
Yeah.
You know, again, depending on how much you value his defense versus, you know, in terms of defensive runs saved or ultimate zone rating, or if you even subbed in some of the Statcast numbers, it's hard to make a case that Vlad was that much better. And I think that's the biggest problem with including the team component, is how do you extract what Vlad did from what Marcus Semien did from what Robbie Ray did? And you can say that the Angels were worse off than the Blue Jays. They won 14 fewer games, but you can say if you take a show. So this is the argument that I got a lot. Number one, which was like, if you take Shohei away from the Angels, they're still trash. But if you take Vlad away from the Blue Jays, they're taking a huge step back. But it's like, you can say the exact same thing about Marcus Semien. You can say the exact same thing about Robbie Ray. And the other side of that coin is, even you can try to attribute the success to the Blue Jays, the Blue Jays success to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. exclusively if you want to. But if I'm a team that actually made the playoffs, I'm like, what success is it that they had? Yeah, they won 91 games. They finished fourth. Yeah. They were a fourth place team. So, I mean, I get it. That's what fans do. And there are some fans that can't get past that. And they were like, we like Vlad. We like the Blue Jays. I don't care about anything else. He deserved the MVP. He's my favorite player. Awesome. I get that. But don't try to intellectualize something that is purely emotional, right? Yeah. Like, let it be that. Mm-hmm. Don't try to come at me and argue about it and argue about the merit of a team that you just keep lowering the bar and be like, well, the Blue Jays almost made the playoffs. So those at bats that Vlad had in September were important. It's like, well, obviously you could have done better if they wanted him to make the playoffs. But my other thing is, and this was an argument I got into some guy with about I think I kept saying is like, it's a team award. It's an individual award in a team sport, but it's different than the other team sports in that it is a turn-based game, right? Vlad gets to come up and then he has to wait for eight other guys to hit before he can come up again. Vlad, or Marcus Semien in this case, say, is standing there at second base and someone has to hit him the ball for him to field it.
Yeah.
All right. And he has to wait his turn as well. You can, in other sports, if it's in basketball, for example, if it's Kyle Lowry has the ball every possession he's on the court. Kyle Lowry initiates the offense. The quarterback snaps the ball. Obviously, he's dependent on his linemen and his receivers and stuff like that. But you can funnel the chances to the standout players in all the other sports. You can't do that in baseball. So you have to take them at their own individual contribution. So the fact that the Blue Jays front office is smarter than the Angels front office right now, the fact that the Blue Jays front office saw it in their infinite wisdom to sign Marcus Semien and sign Robbie Ray and the Angels didn't, why does Vlad get credit for that in an October award? He doesn't. It's stupid. And again, with what Ohtani did, there's no, like, you talk yourself into circles. You're not going to come up with a better, like, he did more to help his team win. And maybe when, for me, before we move on a little bit, which is that the down ballots, or sorry, the if I'm looking for a tiebreaker, that's when I look to win probability added. I look to clutch performance. And so if you look at, say, if you look at wins above replacement, there's a batting runs component, and that those runs are added in, you know, in a context neutral way. Vlad had what, 110 walks or something like that, 48 home runs, all that stuff gets computed in and it spits out a context neutral runs component. Those are the runs that he created, right? When right weighted runs created plus, those are the runs that he created. But if you take that number and look, contrast it with their batting runs created in win probability added, is it higher? Is it lower? Right. And that's a number where Vlad actually suffers a little bit, because his clutch performance was worse than his context neutral performance. He didn't have a great season in high leverage in late close. He was fine, and he still led the league, the Blue Jays, in championship probability added and win probability added, because he just got so on base so many times. All those things count, but Shohei Ohtani was a lot clutcher, for whatever that's worth. But again, he can't create his own clutch. Nobody can. They can't create your own clutch situations. You can't say, okay, the bases are loaded, see anything, send Vlad up now because we need a hit. He's already been up. He's probably standing on third base, or he's waiting in the on-deck circle. And if the game ends with him standing there, there's nothing you can do about it. So an amazing season by Vlad. He's going to get one. There's no doubt. This, you know, while as great as this season was, and as foolish it would be for us to expect him to do somehow better than this insane season, you do get the sense that this is just the beginning. And for Vlad.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one thing that I wonder about Shohei Ohtani, like moving forward? Like, obviously, this is like a bar setting year for them, in the sense of like how you explained it. Like, yeah, he pitched 130 innings, but he was very good pitcher. And he was also like one of the best designated hitters. And so I think, though, part of the reason why he got a lot of votes, understandably so, is because he was doing both things. And so I just wonder if, like, now that he's been awarded for doing both things and doing both things very well, the fact that he just does both things is not going to cut it anymore. Like, I do wonder, like, how people are going to vote moving forward, because he's probably not going to stop doing both things for a few years now, assuming health, right? And, you know, maybe next year he doesn't hit as well, or maybe next year he doesn't pitch as well. And so then that just sort of lowers his MVP caliber anyway, in the sense is like, well, he's not really a good pitcher. But I just wonder, like, how people are going to reconcile, because if the whole thing was like, oh, well, Vlad would have won if only he was also a pitcher. And so that's sort of automatically suggests that, well, because Shohei's doing both, he's MVP every year because no one else is doing both. But you can't necessarily make that argument every single year, because then it's like, well, then there's just kind of no debate ever, right? Like, unless another two-way player comes around. So, like, how do you kind of view that? Like, do you think that this is the bar setting year for Shohei? And unless he has a season that exceeds it, he's not necessarily an MVP favorite, because it would sort of just be like, well, now we're just giving you the award because you do both, which it kind of is unfair in some ways, as much as he's doing something incredible and that's all his talent. But like, a guy like Vlad's not going to learn how to pitch just to win MVP.
So I'm glad you brought this up. This is something I had some kind of, like, you know, Twitter debates and conversations with some people about it. Number one, he's not going to do it again, I think, is the sad truth.
Yeah.
What he did, and the reason that, like, I woke up every morning in awe that it was happening, is because, and the reason that no one else has done it before, is because it's so goddamn hard. Like, there was somebody, it was Brandon Wiley at the Score, wrote a story, and he talked to a bunch of different people, and he talked to, you know, Garrett Cole about like what he thinks about watching Ohtani, and it's like, a starting pitcher's workload is crazy, and they have their days are scripted, and they have so much work that they've got to do, and they got to run, and they got to throw, and they've got to do prep, and they've got to just do the shit that they do, and then to do that as well as playing every single day, to be able to do it at the end of the year. So he got tired, right? Like, there's no debating. Yeah. So even that said, so Ohtani had a really rough couple of weeks in September. His second half numbers were closer to his first half numbers than Vlad's second half numbers were to his first half numbers. Technically, Vlad fell off more. Vlad's second half was like 100, almost 200 points worse than his first half by OPS. Ohtani was about 50 points behind. to do that, that's natural, because to even just to pitch a full season is so difficult and so hard on your body. To throw 100 miles an hour, to want to throw 100 pitches. He was only pitching every sixth day, which might have made it a little bit easier. So for him to have done that is such an unbelievable feat that I don't think he'll be able to do it again, because it's too hard. It's too much for your body, for your mind to stay at that level, to do that insane level of preparation, to get as big as he got in the offseason and come in and ride it through the whole season. I don't think he'll be able to do it again. The other point is the Shohei fatigue factor is real, and it's already here. And you can see it in the fact that people were arguing with me that he deserved it. And I'm like pulling my hair out, like, are you out of your fucking mind? Like they're like, it's a novelty. It's like, yeah. It's the greatest. It's like, this isn't like, you know, I think Craig Calcaterra had a line about like, if a racehorse had won the first two legs of the Triple Crown and then fell down, you know, in the home stretch of the whatever the last one, the Belmont, like, I don't know, the last one of the year, you probably still vote that horse the horse of the year. But if he's won the first two legs of the Triple Crown and then a goddamn unicorn appears, like comes out of a spaceship and then beats the field by 40 laps, like that unicorn is the horse of the year. It's something that you've never seen before. But people were already sick of it. They're sick of it. It's because the scale of what he did is so great. You can't see both sides of it. It's like standing beside one of those gigantic container ships. Like, you can't wrap your head around how big it is and how much it is. So it's easy to be like, yeah, it's a big boat. What the fuck? I don't care. Like, what he did was, so people are bored of it already.
Yeah, I agree. And it does feel like, as much as this vote and him winning was the numbers completely backed up the fact that he deserved it, especially like on the hitting side. But it does feel like this vote was very much like, here you go. We are awarding you for your incredible accomplishment of doing both these things. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you like, I think most of the voters, like, obviously they weighed the numbers and all that kind of stuff, but they also were like, how could we not vote for this guy? That's how you get unanimous. Like, no, everybody had the exact same thought as like, this is like, you know, there's no contest here. Like, there's not much of a debate. And so, but it does feel like I agree with the latter point you made of that, the fatigue factor setting in, and like, and it's kind of crazy because it's like, it's not even just a fatigue factor, but it's like, because he's done it once, we're like, oh, big deal. He's doing it second year. Okay, well, whatever. Do something new. Like, you know, so I feel like it's also just that. It's like, well, he's already done it now. And so, you know, maybe if he's going to now start playing second base as well, maybe we'll like, then it's like adding a new trick. But like, really, he doesn't have to. But I agree. Could.
Maybe,
like,
maybe that's it. Maybe that's the next vanguard for him is not DHing. It's playing right field, which I bet my life he could do. He could play right field every day. He could play right field 4 days a week, DH once, and pitch the other day. And that's the only way that he's going to be able to top what he did this year.
Yeah.
And I'm glad in a way, as someone who is obviously like, I'm emotionally invested in Ohtani's success because I like to see things that I've never seen before in my life and I'll never see again. To bear witness to this feat, I feel lucky every single day when I can watch the game on my TV, or I can pull the highlights up on my phone and I can look at it and it's real and it's unbelievable. And I'm blessed to have been experienced this as a baseball fan and watcher. I'm glad that he had a really good season like he did on both fronts this year, because if this was the first time he did it both for the full season and was worse than he was at one of them, it would have been harder for them to give him the award, but they also would have been a bit more of like a pat on the head, because that's the question, right? Is, and you asked it, which is like, if he does this next year, but he only pitches 130 innings and has like a 4 ERA and he has like an 800 OPS, is he still the MVP? And that's where it gets really dicey, because I there's a big part of me that thinks that he is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's not fair that Vlad can't pitch, but like, that's the whole thing.
That's
no
whole
one
point.
Else can do that. It's like saying it's not fair that Barry Bonds was the best player ever, even, you know, before and after, you know, he started putting all that junk in his body or whatever he did, quote unquote, no libel or anything like that here. But like, it's not fair that Barry Bonds was that much better than everybody else. So like, should we have given a bunch of extra MVP awards to, I don't know, Jeff Bagwell or somebody like that? Like, it's not that it's not fair that this guy who does, the only person ever on earth who can do these things that he does. I don't think fair is the best way to describe that he has gifts and talents and the work ethic and determination and ability to do something that no one's ever done. I don't think fair is the right way to go.
Yeah.
But I think that there is going to be a, if he does it again and he's healthy, there is a debate on like where, what on the low end of either performance does it still make him the best and most compelling, not the compelling piece, make him the best and most valuable player in the league. There is a question in there. And I think again, this year, even if you just add the two versions of wins above replacement together, it still made a pretty, it makes a pretty clear and compelling case that he was that. But if it starts to get closer, it's going to be a really odd and interesting and potentially ugly debate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we wait and see where it goes.
I'm just glad that we got to see it. Because the last thing I'll say about this, which is like, if you come at it from a homer perspective, which is okay, if you're a Blue Jays fan and you watch the Blue Jays and you don't care about anybody else, like literally imagine what would happen if Alek Manoah hit 50 home runs. Right? Like Alek Manoah did all the same stuff that he did, plus he hit 50 home runs.
Plus he was a rookie.
Well, okay.
I'm just kidding.
If he was a rookie, if Alek Manoah showed up and they called him up, he's like, oh, but I don't know, guys, I can swing it. Maybe let me DH today. And then he hit 50 home runs. Like, that's what he did, right? He pitched as well, if better than Alek Manoah, had more starts because he wasn't, you know, in the minors, pitched as well or better than Alek Manoah and hit almost as well as Vlad. Was the second best hitter in baseball behind Vlad, combined with Alek Manoah. Like, wrap your head around it. It's hard to do. More Spin Rate coming up right after these words from our sponsors.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Let's talk about Alek Manoah. He did get some Rookie of the Year votes, which is nice. That's nice, I think. I think you can't really, I don't think you'd be crazy to say that he deserved to win. I think maybe I was surprised he didn't get more. I think Alek Manoah had an even better year than it looks. And I saw Mudman Mike Petriello had some charts going, and I wrote a story about fastballs, and I can't remember what was the context of the story. But he had all these leaderboards, like who are the top fastballs, guys who get swing and misses with their fastballs, best fastballs by these measures. Alek Manoah's name up there on all those lists. He's really, really good. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah, I think if he had started the season in the majors, I think he would have been in the top three. I think for me, this was one of the award that I voted for. And I have voted for Rookie of the Year in the past as well. And so behind the curtain, all the awards are different in the sense of how many finalists you have to put down. Cy Young is 5, I believe. Mm-hmm. MVP is 10. Mm-hmm. Rookie of the Year is 3. So you only have to do 3. And I know like it shows up as like more people getting votes and stuff, but you only have to pick 3. And so when I was like weighing it, like I think Alek Manoah was definitely in my top 5. He just wasn't in my top 3. And we just have to put 3 down. So I think if he had been in this the majors all season long and made 30 starts or whatever, 28, 29 starts or whatever it may be, I think he would have been in the top three. As long as his numbers would have been similar.
Mm-hmm. So one of the votes that Manoah got was from Rob Longley, the Toronto Sun. Shout out, the homer vote. Can't sneeze at it, but Manoah did get two votes. He got another vote from somebody else. From Jen McCaffrey. Wait, that's not right. Jesse Rogers, ESPN, Chicago. You voted, Caitlin, for Randy Arozarena, Luis Garcia, and Wander Franco.
Yes.
Hard to argue with that. That is pretty much how the ballot broke down. Real quick, why Arozarena?
I think it was just the overall numbers, the fact that he played the full season. I mean, it was tough. It was tough deciding between Wander Franco, because what he did in this short span of time was incredible. And so I definitely wanted to have him in my top three. Mm-hmm. But then it was also Wayne Garcia, who pitched a full season as a rookie, and his numbers were really good as well for the Astros. So then it was like, well, if I give it to Franco, but he only played 70 games or whatever it was, and then you're not giving credit to a guy who's pitching every, I don't know. So like that to me, like, and also Rookie of the Year is tough because it's a little bit like MVP in that sense of you're not just voting for a specific skill type. Like you can be pitchers and it can be hitters. I mean, MVP is usually hitters, because there's a Cy Young. So unless like a pitcher is so incredible, I think it's fairly rare to see MVP Cy Young being the same guy. So
like, was it 2013 Verlander, 2014 Verlander wasn't one both, but anyway, sorry.
Yeah. But that it happens or whatever, but it's pretty rare. But with rookie, it's everyone, you're kind of trying to weigh everybody differently. And so that's why I say with Alec Manoah, like the only reason he was, I felt like Garcia had one up on him was the fact that he pitched a lot more starts. So that's kind of how it broke down. And I don't know. I mean, it's not completely complicated. I think that Arozarena had a better second half, was it? I think he came out a lot stronger in the second half. Yeah. And so, but it's still the overall numbers, I think, were strong enough playing the most amount of games. I mean, I guess you kind of also look a little bit at the performance, not that you're supposed to weigh the performance year before, but you kind of consider what he had done previous and thought, you know, he kind of carried that over. Although Eno Saros wrote a really interesting thing about the award and whether Arozarena's best days are already behind him. That's kind of where I came to. And I'm always kind of like curious to see how my votes shake out compared to how it goes. And I think most years I've been pretty aligned. I think most years who I voted for first has been the winner. And sometimes there's like a standout. Like the first year I voted actually was Shohei Ohtani's rookie year and he won. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what other years I voted, but I just have a recollection of like usually there being a pretty standout rookie, which makes it a little bit easier.
See, this year is interesting, and I think that you touched on it, but in a more professional way than I will, which is to say that I think the Rookie of the Year is one you can get a little wild with. Rookie of the Year, and I know Keith Law has talked about this before.
And I like Keith. I know you're going to get to, and I do like Keith's point of like recognizing someone who projects out to stick around. Like you want to award someone for a rookie season, but you also kind of want to weigh other things like their age and their staying power and their skill and all that kind of stuff. And so if it's a guy who had his rookie year and he's 29, you know, or if a guy's 20, like Wander Franco, I think Arozarena kind of falls in the, he's a little older, 25-ish maybe.
He's too old. He's
getting up there.
You can say it. He's too old. because I think if push come to shove, and looking to probably get some content out of it on the back end, I probably would have voted for Wander Franco. Number one, because he doesn't dictate when he gets called up, right? The Rays are going to keep him down and they're going to do the things that they need to do for their own payroll and their own situation down the road. So, you know, they moved, the Willy Adames out, mm-hmm. right? They made room, but they didn't call him up for a little while yet. So, I probably would have voted for Wander Franco. There was some great down ballot nonsense on this ballot. Just absolutely delightful. Both Rangers writers, who none of whom work for the Athletic, thank goodness, voted for Adolis Garcia, which is hilarious because he had one good month. He made the All-Star team, plays a heck of an outfield, really had one good month, was like basically turned himself into Randall Grichuk by the end of the year, but like got some Rookie of the Year votes. Whatever. I want to give a special shout out. I didn't do this before. I don't know if you've seen this. The National League MVP ballot. This was probably one of the best ballots I've ever seen.
Oh, MVP? Okay,
The National League MVP ballot.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about.
Which Bryce Harper of the Phillies won. Which it was pretty tight, right? There was obviously going to be some votes for Tatis Jr., for Juan Soto, even though not Juan Soto for an also ran club, Brandon Crawford, whatever else. Jim Salisbury, who covers the Phillies, put together. Oh wait, is that him?
Let's make sure you get the name right.
Let me get the name right. Where is it? Where is this?
You got to put it on the second page.
Yeah, yeah. That somebody did just the Lord's work and like on their ballot, they buried Fernando Tatis Jr. and Juan Soto to ensure that Bryce Harper got all the right votes. Is it this one? Oh, I can't remember. Anyway, it wasn't, what's his name? The guy that I said, Jim Salisbury, but, whoever it was, there was
okay,
just some really,
yeah, I see.
No, it was Jim Salisbury, who covers the Phillies for NBC Sports Philadelphia. He voted Bryce Harper first, then he voted Trey Turner, Paul Goldschmidt, Austin Riley, Brandon Crawford, and then Fernando Tatis Jr., and then Juan Soto. I love it. Oh my God, it's so good. Anyway, go check up on that. And the last one, of course, was Charlie Montoyo, who got some votes for manager of the year. This is the one that is easily the most challenging, I think, to vote for, but also like the most challenging to justify your vote. Kevin Cash wins back-to-back manager of the year because Kevin Cash is, of course, made of magic, as it turns out. But then, Scott, again, like, so
you talk,
what does Scott Service do to deserve winning manager of the year?
So this is the thing with manager of the year is like you talk about how to weigh team performance and MVP. Well, like mm-hmm. that's essentially what manager of the year award is you're weighing the team performance based on you're weighing the team performance against preseason expectations,
mm-hmm.
or you're also weighing team performance and number of injuries and or other obstacles team had to encounter throughout the season. And so you have Kevin Cash, who by now we all know he works for a team that like a small market team. They had a lot of injuries, but they also sort of squeeze every last ounce of juice out of their stable of pitchers. They don't have any stars, and they are a very good team. And so he gets a lot of credit, mm-hmm. I think, for the fact that he manages with what he has and he does a really good job with what he has. With Seattle, the situation was obviously what I said is like you take the team performance basically against what you had preseason expectations, and you say, well, they were a club that won 90 games and nobody thought that they were going to win 90 games. Mm-hmm. So he must have been doing something right. And that's kind of what it comes down to. And so when you talk about Charlie Montoyo getting a few votes, I mean, I guarantee a lot of people gave him some votes, some credit for navigating a season where his team had to play in three home ballparks and getting them to 91 wins. And so, I've never voted for a manager. And I do know that it's one that writers have a hard time voting for, because unless you're a beat writer on that team, you really don't know another team's manager. And so like for me with the Blue Jays, like obviously I know Charlie Montoyo really well, and I could probably give you some arguments for why he was deserving of some manager of the year votes. But I don't know the other manager very well. You don't, and if you've been in the industry a long enough time, maybe you do know some other managers and you've encountered a lot of different people and you can ask around. But really when it comes down to it, that award just is like, you have to kind of base it on like what their team did and how they got there and how they got through it and were there obstacles or were there injuries or were there whatever, like, and see how they managed it essentially. And it's, there's no real science to it.
I would agree. And I think that it is, it, I think it, because of the nuance involved, as you just, you know, so eloquently described, it makes it really hard to vote for anybody that isn't the guy that you cover, frankly. And the only other way that you're doing it is as you describe, where it's like, well, I thought they were going to be bad, but they're good. So the manager must have done something right. So you can give credit, or you can do it, you know, more of a narrative thing, which is like Charlie Montoyo helped to steer the ship of a young team through a really unprecedented, uncharted waters, this crazy season where they were here, there, and everywhere. And they ended up winning 91 games. And he deserves a lot of credit for that. But then you can look at Scott Servais and you can say, okay, maybe you look at what's happened. It's not just that Seattle won 90 games. It's that Seattle won 90 games in a really crazy way, which is all those one run games, all those extra inning games. You know, they won games that they shouldn't have. They had this crazy record, but they also had this terrible one run differential. So you give Servais credit. Maybe he pulled all the right strings. He managed the bullpen really well. Not only did he manage the bullpen really well, he was able to manage the bullpen after they traded away Kendall Graveman, you know,
he also had a really good bullpen.
But so is it? So then again, that's where it gets into. Is the bullpen good, or is he putting them in a position to succeed? Which is then comes back to the other side of this, which is like, if you're going to give credit to Scott Servais for helping to put together a great season and to have this team be these Cinderella kids and the unexpected Mariners with their terrible run differential, but their great winning record, you could probably make a case to punish Charlie Montoyo for having like one of the most underperforming teams in all of baseball, a team that by all rights should have been waltzing into the playoffs, that you know, still did so well winning 91 games in a really tough division, but like scored so many more runs and had such a terrible record, especially earlier in the season when the bullpen was bad. You know, is it Montoyo's fault? We've already listed all these individual guys that got awards consideration for the Blue Jays. Seven guys getting, or five guys getting MVP votes and rookie of the year and the winner of the Cy Young and the 2 and 3 in MVP. Like, if you are that type of person who's looking to figure blame out, maybe it's going to land on the manager. But that seems like another debate for another day. Shout out to Charlie Montoyo. I don't give a shit. Whatever. It's fine. Good for you, Charlie. I hope you had a good year. He deserves credit for helping keeping all those guys on the same page and managing through some weird stuff. So, which is, again, it comes back to, it ends up being more about like the speaker, which is like, I view the manager as the baseball dad, and he has to dad it up for 25 different grown men at different parts of the season. So, well, 26. Dadded, Charlie Montoyo. 26
grown men.
Plus it's 2021. So it's realistically like more like 45 different guys that are on the roster at different points. Speaking of the roster, last thing, 40-man roster moves are made ahead of the deadline. Blue Jays added, you wrote about this, Hagen Danner, Bowden Francis. Bowden Francis came from which trade?
The Rowdy Tellez trade.
Rowdy Tellez trade. Shout out Rowdy Tellez. Zach Logue, who is an intriguing name, and Leo Jimenez, all added to the 40-man roster. And Sean Anderson was added off of waivers from the San Diego Padres. Do we have any big or exciting opinions about these players that are added?
No, I don't think anything. I mean, I'm not entirely well versed in every level of prospect for the Blue Jays. So, Hagen Danner is interesting because he's the converted. Yeah, I guess he was a two-way player in high school, and then he was drafted as a catcher. Tried it out for a couple seasons as catcher, and the Blue Jays have said, no, we like you as a pitcher. And so this was his first season as a full-time pitcher, reliever.
Throwing like 100 miles an hour, right?
Close to, I think Baseball America said something like high 90s or can brush high 90s. So that is an interesting name just because it's like, he's really kind of new to pitching in some respects. They obviously really like him. They obviously think that other teams might like him and want to take a shot on him. So they want to protect him. Leo Jimenez is still really young, but he also is in that sort of upper echelon of their infield prospects. I also think that knowing they might do some dealing this offseason, maybe you want to have some of those guys on your 40 man to make sure their trade value is still there, right? Like you potentially could entice some teams with him. So those are Zach Logue, you mentioned, also a guy that has been name dropped a few times by Ross Atkins in some of his year end sort of availabilities of like going over, you know, performances that they liked. And I think he added some ticks of velocity and that helped him this year in AAA. Then what was the other name? Remind me.
Bowden Francis.
Oh, yes, Bowden Francis. Yeah, so I think that also he just is a bit of starting depth. They don't have a lot of pitching depth, starting pitching depth. They don't have a lot of young starting pitching depth. And, like, you know, not that you necessarily want to, like, be in a situation where you're, like, relying on, like, Anthony Kay and Thomas Hatch to be making – and Bowden Francis to be making up your rotation. But I just, like, they don't have a ton. And, like, you need spot starts here and there.
You
and
need
like
10 guys.
They were actually pretty lucky this year with injuries. Like, they did not have very many injuries with their pitchers outside of, like, the guys that miss most of the year, like Nate Pearson. But like their pitching staff this year were like pretty durable. And they were all guys that are like somewhat known for their durability. Like Manoa pitched a lot in college, Barrios obviously coming, Ray, Steven Matz. Like they've all like been guys that like pitched a lot and like didn't have hugely significant injuries. Anyway, but that's not, that can change next year. Like they could have a lot of injuries. So I think they need that depth. I guess two names that stand out that like didn't get taken would be like Eric Pardino, who like was the name a couple years ago, if you remember, like really young still. But he's just missed a lot of time. I think he really only graduated to like low A level, and he just had Tommy John last year and he basically missed this entire season trying to come back from it. And Joey Murray, who was like kind of a low under the radar darling a couple years ago and was getting some attention coming into this year, and he like missed the entire season with an injury, which I don't really know much about. I don't even think I was kind of searching my notes and trying to figure out what it was, and I truthfully don't really know. And it was not really talked about, so I'm not sure if it was like one of those sort of like hockey-esque upper body lower body injuries, undisclosed injury type of thing, or just we never got around to knowing much about it. But anyway, those were two names that kind of were like, oh, they didn't protect them. But I mean, I don't know, it's the Rule 5 draft. I don't even know when the Rule 5 draft is gonna be happening this year with the potential lockout. And also there is just so many reliever types, pitchers that are available, and it's so rare for guys to stick. It's, you know, every season there's maybe like one or two guys that were selected in the Rule 5 and they hit, but it doesn't happen very often. And so most often, like, teams sometimes don't mind the risk. Like, look at a couple years ago, Jordan Romano was not protected. He was selected by, I think, the White Sox and immediately traded to the Rangers, who tried him out as a reliever. He made it pretty far into their spring training. I think just basically didn't make one of the final cuts and was sent back to the Blue Jays. And then the Blue Jays converted him to a reliever, and now he is basically their starter, or starter, their closer, excuse me. And so like that's, and Jordan Romano was pretty like polished at that point. Like he, and it was a Rangers team that I don't think was a very competitive Rangers team, and he still didn't stick. So it's, you know, it's pretty, it's hard. Mm-hmm. And like, even in the time, like the Blue Jays kind of like gamed the system a little bit a couple years ago with Luciano, Joe Biagini a couple years back but he was also like older, and he, I think he had been a starter in the minors. The Blue Jays tried him as a reliever and it worked for a little while, and they got that out of it, but it doesn't. And that was, again, like I said, it's one or two or three or four guys per season end up sticking around on a team.
And even the years beyond that are really unlikely, too, that they even stick, right? Like, sometimes it is more like the Joe Biagini
Yes. And sometimes, yeah, exactly. It's right. It's like, you know, 1 year, because that's just how kind of relieving can work sometimes. You can have two really good seasons and then you can kind of just fall off a little bit. I don't even know where Joe Biagini is right now. Like where he, I lost track of him after the Astros trade.
I think he made his way back to the big leagues this year. Actually.
I think he did.
But, The one that I'm was thinking about is Samad Taylor.
Yeah.
I think that's the interesting one. I think that if anyone's going to get claimed, it'll be him, because he's just so toolsy, right? Like, you know,
for sure. And he's the type of guy that could stick because a rebuilding team could use him as like a fifth outfielder that they use as a pinch runner because he's really speedy and he can play at a bunch of different positions. I think the one reason why I can see the Blue Jays not protecting him is that on their particular roster, he's a bit redundant at this point. Like they have a lot of those guys. They have a lot of those guys that are, what position are they? Like the Biggios, the Kevin Smith, Valera, Otto Lopez. Like these are all guys that you're like, they don't have a position because they move around, and that's what the Blue Jays have done with them. They've molded them into these two, like these utility guys.
They play Jose Ramirez's position, so they're not needed anymore. Joe Biagini made one appearance with the Cubs this year. With Chicago. So yeah, I think Samad Taylor is the guy that will probably get selected. Obviously the Blue Jays liked him when they picked him up in the Joe Smith trade back in 2017, but had an interesting season. But you know, maybe there's a little bit too much swing and miss for the Blue Jays liking. Yeah. God only knows. But yeah, that's it. I think that's it. This has gone on way too long enough.
Yeah,
way too long.
Well, you know what? We have to give our fans something to chew on. We don't come on as often, so.
If anyone thought that we were going to do an episode around the awards season and there, so there was going to be a significant chunk of Shohei Ohtani time and think that I was going to get out of here in any kind of a reasonable amount of space, they're dreaming. They're just purely dreaming. So this has been good. Caitlin, thank you so much. I love to talk about this stuff. I am a sucker, as I said, for the down ballot nonsense. Shout out to Jim Salisbury. Shout out to the guys in Texas who just like throw caution to the wind. Just be like, whatever, our guy, first place, let's go. And have yourself a good time. So Caitlin, what else? What do you have coming up? You got your lawyer hat on yet?
No. I think I'm going to leave that to like the Ken Rosenthal and Evan Jelliches of the world and just kind of let them lead that story.
I think that's wise.
Yeah. This whole thing doesn't totally impact my content plans in the sense that a lot of the offseason is slow anyway, and the Blue Jays have I don't know what I can remember, but like things generally didn't ever get going much until mid-December, late December, or sometimes early January. Like George Springer was not till January. Hyunjin Ryu a couple years ago was like right around Christmas time. So I am used to creating content for a lot of number of weeks when things are not happening. So, you know, it'll just be more like sort of forecasting ahead and looking at what the Blue Jays roster looks like now, what they need, and all that kind of stuff. So that's what you'll get from me for the next few weeks. And hopefully by January, we're talking about an actual baseball season and a CBA and transactions again.
I believe that Evan Jelliches has a new podcast that's going to be going around through this thing. Is that fair to say?
Maybe our producer can give us a note, but I think he's taking over one of the slots on the baseball show, which
that sounds about right. But anyway, it's easy to get out over your skis when you're not like someone it's on the Athletic baseball show. That's right. Evan Jelliches will be popping up there to talk about the labor situation, which what I was trying to say is it's easy to get out over your skis and sort of talk out of turn when it comes to the real nuance of a lot of these pieces. It's such a big, massive undertaking, the collective bargaining agreement. I think all you can do is if you're not in that position is hope that there is labor peace, and more accurately, not hope that labor peace, hope that there is labor equity, that they make a good, fair deal, that the players are able to collectively bargain on their own behalf, as well as the minor leaguers, as well as the players that are coming up in the up and coming days, and ensure that there is a fair share of this enormous pot of revenue that you know, the hopefully the players are more and more, I think the players are getting shut out from some of these revenue pieces as they are building up these real estate deals around these stadiums. And there's just so many more opportunities for the owners to make money. So hopefully players are able to get a good cut. So that's all I hope for. Get a good deal but without losing sight of the value of the game undertaking. And not to say that like, well, you can't don't take the games from the fans. Like, that's the leverage that the owners want you to want to use against the players. Just hope that they're able to get a good and fair deal and that we don't have to go too long without baseball. But mm-hmm. hopefully in the name of solidarity, if it comes to that, I'll wait. But I hope I don't have to. And I hope that they're able to reach a fair deal soon, quick and easily, which don't have high hopes for because there's a lot of money at stake and they want to make sure they get everything taken care of. So keep your ear to the ground, listening to the Athletic Baseball Show, where they'll break that down. And then we'll be back again when we need to be back again, I think is what's fair to say. No immediate plans right now, but hopefully we'll be back before the end of the year to talk more about your Toronto Blue Jays. In the meantime, go to theathletic.com/spinrate, sign up for catch that hot deal for the next 12 months. You can read everything that Caitlin writes here going through the off season. You can read my Vlad stuff. I've got some fun plans for the stuff in the off season. I've got to get around to doing it. Got a couple other projects on the go that are taking up a lot of my time, as well as spending every waking moment in a hockey arena somewhere or driving to another child sport activities. You can read the newsletter at fairservice.substack.com. Her name is Caitlin. My name is Drew. Talk to you next time on Spin Rate.